Right, well, welcome to this week's newsletter podcast. Based upon the newsletter that we write on a weekly basis, this is Kirby Lachrungy and Dawn Riddler for Rexilom. This is week number 42, hastening towards the end of the year, and markets are certainly keeping us very, very interested and quite frankly entertained at this stage. Dawn, if I look at the week, here's what the markets look like for the week. So the S&P 500 for the week is down 2.39%. That's a meaningful slowdown on the week. The Nasdaq led with down 3.16%. So that's quite a big move for the Nasdaq now for the week. And then if you look at the small cap index, down 2.26% in the United States. In a similar fashion, the FTSE 100 was down 2.6% for the week. And then if you go across and you look at the Shanghai, down 3.40%, Nikkei down 3.27%. So generally just a negative week as far as markets are concerned, as they weigh the current economic environment, the potential looming recession in the United States, the already situation in China where their property market is shaky and where they're dealing with fallouts of that. And then obviously on the background drop of that, there's the Ukrainian Russian crisis and also the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. If you look at bonds, US 2-year bonds are now trading at 5.07%, 10 years at 4.94%, and 20 years for the US is up at 5.28%. And for the week, we've seen yields again push quite higher. So US 10-year yields now for the year, John, year to date, US 10-year yields are now up 26.7% from where they started at the beginning of the year. And that just shows you how interesting this environment is that we're living in. The bond market is telling the Federal Reserve and policymakers that the deficits that they're running in the US, especially that fiscal deficit, is a problem and that they need to start dealing with this. And the problem is, when do they start dealing with it? This is the big question mark in everybody's minds.
And I think, Kirby, and we've discussed this before, I frankly don't think that this administration, Biden's administration, is going to handle it at all. They're going to wait until this time next year. By this time next year, the presidential election is, to all intents and purposes, over, and it'll become the next administration's problem. Hopefully, in my opinion, it'll still be a Biden problem because the alternative is a Trump problem, and he doesn't handle problems at all. Doesn't understand them, I don't think. So, this is something that I think the Americans are going to have to live with. I think it's very interesting, but it also, in my opinion, opens up opportunities maybe for American investors, which is not good news for the stock markets in America, because American investors are going to look at the 5% that they can get, to all intents and purposes, risk-free, and have a look at the declining stock markets and perhaps move more of their money in that direction.
That's been the case really since the beginning of the year, where investors are looking at bond yields in the US and saying, but why? These are fairly attractive. And quite frankly, they've just become more attractive as bond yields have continued to rise. The problem that one faces is when one buys those yields and yields continue to rise, then one takes an inherent capital loss in the actual price of the actual instrument. So if you look at just a broad-based index of the US 20-year bond, it's called TLT. Now, TLT is an exchange-traded fund that trades, and it actually mimics the movement of the 20-plus Treasury yield curve. If you look at something like this, I mean, it has lost significant amounts of money. If you take the maximum amount of data available, this price index peaked at over $170. You could buy that whole bond index at the moment for $83. So that just gives you an indication about the price movement. So by just trading bonds, by putting money into 20-year bonds, the yield rise has, from top to bottom, we're talking about a 50% loss in bonds. Wow, that looks like equities now. That's volatility that you kind of assume with as far as equities are concerned. So I think the international market for 60/40 portfolios have changed, and this will be the second year that we've seen negative results and negative returns for the bond market in the United States. Emerging markets, I think, is different. 60/40 portfolios here in South Africa still have done just fine, and I think across other emerging markets have done okay. But certainly in the United States, until they get a handle on the bond market and where this bond market is going, and how to actually get a proper yield reading that is conducive to economic growth long term, this is going to be a very, very tough sell, I think, into portfolios. So, Dawn, I think a couple of the tools available. I mean, I think you quite rightly point out in this week's newsletter, the whole bent on trying to get inflation down to 2%. Yes, absolutely. I think that's the one thing that's busy happening. But at the same token, the other thing that they might start looking at doing is if they can't get that number right and they can't, and they continue and say they even start dropping interest rates, but yields just don't respond on the bond curve, they might start doing what's called yield curve control. And that in essence means you're manipulating the yield curve by physically buying your own bonds or selling your own bonds in order to try and get a specific yield curve out of the equation. The Japanese have done this for a long period of time. There's a certain part of the curve at the shorter end that they've been targeting to try and keep it as low as they possibly can. And the Americans might just end up doing exactly the same thing. That has its own ramifications, obviously, for economic growth, which we could chat about at some point down the line.
So, Kobe, one of the things that I looked at now, talking about Japan, and we continue to look at China. The one thing that really came out to me today, and I did sort of discuss it a little bit in the newsletter, is that there's very little doubt that Xi is a completely different political animal than we have seen in China really since Mao. His policies are starting to become embedded in that whole region, not just in China. And what is interesting is that, and now there's a little bit conspiracy theory around it, is that the zero COVID, the strict zero COVID restrictions that they had in China right up until earlier this year were very good indication for Xi just how to control that populace and how effective they could be, even though it's 1.7 billion people. They managed to impose such strict controls. But the thing is that the West has noticed, the West is backtracking. Foreign investment is way down. You know, nobody's wanting to touch China with a barge pole. And this just adds to the whole interesting sort of dynamics, especially around emerging markets, because obviously a lot of our commodities go to China. And if China is not thriving, our commodities are not going to go to China. And it has a long-term impact on us as well.
So, Donna, I think you're 100% right. I think the China under Xi Jinping is one of a two-state system. You've got the Communist Party that makes the decisions as far as the fiscal and monetary base of the country is concerned and as far as people groups are concerned. And then within that, you have companies that operate. There's strict guidelines for them. They can have, in certain cases, they can have capitalistic mindsets, but it always has to be within the confines of the central party system. That is the world that Xi Jinping kind of lives in. It's this one-party system. Now, the one thing that a one-party system can do quite easily is they can turn on the taps. They may decide at some point, listen, actually, we would love to print more money, and they can do so. And if most economists point to them and say, but listen, this is unsustainable, then the Chinese will say, well, we're not a capitalistic system. We're a centrally planned system, and we can do what we want here, because we don't adhere to the same standards. Whereas if the Americans do it, the Americans at some point will have to switch it off, because at heart, they believe in free capital and capitalism as a base case. So the Chinese have got dollars to spend. They can save their own system by printing money or just going into quantitative easing mode. At this stage of the game, I think they've kind of got a check and balance on things. They know that it is slowing. They know there's a problem in the property market. But the question is, what do they do about it and when do they do it? And it's a bit of a waiting game, because I think there's a bit of an economic war happening against the Americans at the moment. The Americans' enemies know that the US is running massive deficits and is from a fiscal perspective. Those deficits are starting to be likened to what we saw in the very early 1940s. And that means a world that is just hamstrung by debt. On the horizon, both the Ukraine and Russian war, which is going to require more capital from the United States in the form of arms and ammunition. And now there's a secondary crisis, which is the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And those two crises alone, if there's a third and a fourth crisis that join with those, well, you might not need a world war. You might just have like a whole bunch of smaller skirmishes happening across the world, achieving exactly the same thing as what a large war would potentially achieve. These fiscal deficits that countries are running in the Western world will require attention at some point. The bond market in the US is saying, please give this thing attention. You need to do something about this. And the question is, when does that happen? And how does that happen? Because you might find the market down perhaps another 20% before the Fed says, listen, Actually, we need to do something about this bond market because we can't carry on doing this because nobody knows how to price equities in this kind of environment.
We're living in interesting times, as they say, Kobe. There's obviously here in South Africa, obviously quite a lot of euphoria around both the Cricket World Cup and the Rugby World Cup. You know, the guys in green and gold seem to be covering themselves in glory. And there's always this overflow of euphoria. And it seems to be right across the racial divide, you know, which is really lovely to see for the first time, probably in a very long time, that you're seeing this, you know, coming together as a nation. But one of the things that I talk about, and we do talk about it endlessly, the one thing that I've picked up a graph and showed in the newsletter, the failure of Transnet and how Transnet is bringing everyone down. But more importantly than that, the fact that we as South Africans seem to be very resilient and the sheer uptake of solar panels in the last year and in the last 2 years is absolutely phenomenal. You know, those numbers are starting to come out. There's over 4,000 megawatts already been built. And there's another 2,000 in solar panels that have already been imported and are currently being installed. So, I mean, that's 6,000 awful lot of power. And it is just symptomatic of just how resilient South Africans can be.
Yeah. And look, we're going to have to be because, and this is quite interesting. I think the reality that South Africa has lived is in a fairly unequal country where demographically we have people, a small percentage of the population that controls a large portion of the wealth and a large proportion of the population continuing to control very little of the economy. Now, that obviously becomes a political hot potato, Dawn. And we've lived that reality for quite a long period in South Africa. That reality is becoming a reality in other parts of the world. In the US, it's becoming a reality. Europe, it's going to become a reality. So the thing that we've lived for quite a long period of time is becoming reality in other parts of the world. If one looks at where the polls are, so the Brentos Foundation did a research study around where they think the national vote could be come next year's election. They see the ANC from 48% down to 41%. They see the DA from 24 to 23%. But then they see the EFF at 11 to 17%. So now the question begs, well, if the ANC gets 41% of the vote and the DA and the EFF gets a very good 17% of the vote, there's a coalition potentially waiting to happen between those two. You might not call it a coalition. You might just call it an agreement. You know, they might just support each other, you know, regardless of there being an actual written coalition, you know, that it's actually rubber stamped. But the two might actually just support each other and it might just continue along the path that we've been for, quite frankly, the last decade. And in that world, you as a resilient South African would have to make an alternative plan. Because if you don't have an alternative plan, then you're going to continue to have to suffer underneath a government that continues to fragment in front of you. And that's just going to become a reality, I think, for other countries across the world as well.
But what is it you mean by an alternative plan? Pack your bags and trek, Ferreira.
So, Dawn, I don't think there's another place on earth that is just nirvana, where you could just walk in and go, okay, well, there we go. You know, there's this place has no problems and South Africa has all the problems. I think it's a trade-off. And I think that becomes specific to every single individual that has to make that decision. So you might find yourself that you have a skill set and that you are professionally qualified in a certain industry, that you might just look at yourself and say, well, I'm probably better to base myself elsewhere in the world. No problem. You might want to go and do that. You might be, for instance, in the oil industry. Well, South Africa is probably not the right place to be for in the oil industry. You might want to be somewhere in the Middle East, for instance. It depends on your skill set. But South Africa might actually still be the right place for the right type of skill set. You might find yourself making really, really good money in South Africa just because there's less and less people to compete with in a society that is becoming more and more fragmented. But the caveat to that is that you need to be able to look after yourself. And that's a reality that I think that most South Africans have lived with. Eskom failure, get yourself solar panels. People have done that. Water fails, get yourself a borehole, get off the water grid. Transnet fails, well, you've got to make yourself an alternative plan as far as transport is concerned and goods and services is concerned. Then you might find yourself still making economic profits, real economic profits here in South Africa.
It does boil down to that resilience, but also, and we've talked about it at length, that anybody that's listening to this needs to understand that there are options today that probably weren't there 10 years ago, to become a global citizen, to get a work permit, to get the ability to stay in countries, for example, like Portugal and Spain. It's actually fairly easy for anybody on a D7 visa, for example, to go and stay in Portugal and Spain. So you can't sort of sit back and say, I don't have options. So stop bitching about it. The most of what you've got and what you're going to do, be decisive. I think this is one of the things, you know, you and I talk to our clients all the time about whether they should emigrate, and not sometimes not physically emigrate, but how much of their money they should take offshore and why, and how we should invest it. And one of the things that comes across all the time is that have a plan of what you're going to do and where you're going to retire, even if that's in 5 or 8 or whatever it is years time. Have a plan, because it's the people that make the knee-jerk reactions that get really hurt when they're trying to do this. Don't have an emotional response to all of this. Have a measured response and make it so that it's in the best interest of you and your back pocket. You and I are always here to help when it comes to the financial stuff, because doing this kind of thing requires somebody who knows about immigration, requires somebody who knows about finances, requires somebody who knows about tax. All of this can happen seamlessly, and you don't end up cashing in policies that shouldn't be cashed in, or stopping a medical aid when you shouldn't be stopping a medical aid, and all of those kind of things. You just sort of have a plan, and you can then do it over a period of time and reduce the risk of actually impacting your wealth portfolio, which is what we're all about.
So Dawn, here's the tale of two investors. And these are two investors that we've seen by doing the work that we do. The one investor is an investor that goes and lives overseas. They don't have a global business. They have a skill set that they've applied in South Africa, and they're going to try and attempt and apply the same skill set, but perhaps in Europe. And what you find is when you land in Europe, you find that the price for your service, especially if it's just ordinary household type services, you know, it's very basic services, you find yourself competing with the rest of Europe trying to do these services. And the price that you pay for that, the actual income, shall I rather say, that you're earning from that, is rudimentary relative to what you could earn here in South Africa. There's a tale of one investor. First investor would say to you, well, at least I've taken the hard-earned money I've made in South Africa and I've been able to externalize it. And there's nothing wrong with that. There's a specific, that's a specific decision to make. But they've halved their earnings, or even quartered their earnings, in order to now live in Europe. The second type of investor is an investor that has made money in South Africa, done very, very well. They've built businesses here in South Africa, and they've now gone and they're now living in Europe. They're living very well in Europe because they've made a lot of money. But you've got to think by yourselves, because there's a second generation that they take with them to Europe. And when you ask them, what is your second generation going to do? What are they going to be doing in Europe? You start finding that they've sold a very, very good business in South Africa in order for the second generation to do, again, a rudimentary service, such as, I don't know, fix gardens, for instance, or something. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with fixing gardens, but make sure that you get a fair price. Whereas these individuals are earning a very low wage in order to do so. Whereas the first generation, perhaps it was better for him just to hold on to the business in South Africa and then introduce the next generation. And by all means, live between Europe and here in South Africa, that's absolutely no problem. But to pack up lock, stock and barrel and try and move yourself into Europe sometimes is not necessarily the right answer. And that's why this thing has become so specific to the individual, the skill set, who you are, what you are, et cetera, et cetera. It's such a personal question, I think, at the end of the day.
Not only that, Kobe, I mean, I say over and over in my blogs and have done for years and in the advice that I give my clients, is that as a taxpayer, right, as a skilled person in South Africa, if you want longevity in this market, you have to work for yourself.
Yeah.
Bottom line. And that's not providing services as a contractor to a corporate. You have to physically have your own business in one way, shape, or form, because you will have a far better return, because you'll be able to reduce your tax rate, because there'll be so much more that you can actually write off against tax. And nobody can fire you. Nobody can say, you're turning 63, you're turning 65, here's your, you know, couple of cupcakes at Tarbella. So,
yes.
And it's a scary thought, and especially for somebody who might have been in corporate for most of their lives, and maybe they're in their 50s or coming into their 60s, that is the time to actually start thinking about a second career and working for yourself. Because even if you've worked in that company for 30 years, if they need to bring in what fresh blood or anything like this, they will have no compunction about sending you on your way, maybe giving you a contract of a fifth of what you were being paid previously.
Yeah. And these are the nuances I think that one has to think about. So in many, many conversations we've had with clients, some have said, I've looked at living overseas. I've done the calculations. It just doesn't make sense for me at this stage, but I have cassettes overseas. So that's fine. So, you know, if I have to, I could live part of my life there and part of my life here. It's the options. I think when we see clients, Dawn, we like to give clients options, you know, so that there's options for the future, however South Africa might turn up. Because, and again, I come back to this, the world's becoming a more fragmented place, and it will become more fragmented as we go. How many kids this week? I saw a kid that came back from Israel. They were there for 3 months, quite happily living there and quite happily starting a life there because they can. They're back in South Africa. And I said, are you back? They said, I can't stay at this stage. And that's Israel, right? That's Israel. So here they're back in South Africa. So it's a difficult situation, Dawn. I don't think it's nirvana anywhere. And therefore, as an investor, I think you need options.
And I think more than anything else, it's not just options, but it's flexibility. And this is something that both you and I advise our clients against is getting any kind of investment into any kind of termed product or a structured product or an inflexible product, because things just change so damn fast that if you're in some sort of financial what that's inflexible, you know, you're going to have problems if you have to move quickly. Now, obviously, there are intrinsically, there's some investments and that kind of thing that are going to be inflexible, retirement annuities, for example, living annuities, for example. But you have to weigh that up against, you know, the tax breaks, perhaps, that you can get and the estate planning breaks that you can get with them. But this is a detailed conversation to have with a client. And I think one of the most important things for anybody out there who's wanting to invest overseas is to be aware that flexibility does exist. You aren't forced into buying some stupid endowment or some quasi-trust that's an Isle of Man or any of these kind of things. There are flexible options that are way cheaper and way better for you as a family unit so that you can move quickly if you need to.
Those are great insights from Dawn as far as week number 42 is concerned. Remember, nothing that we say on the podcast or the newsletter is advice. If you need advice, that's something that we do in an in-person type way. Thanks for listening to our podcast this week. Remember, it's based upon our newsletter. Go read it, tell your friends about it, and subscribe.